Hamlet famously said, "Speak the speech." Well, actor, author, and director Ben Crystal is the man who was actually able to tell us how the original Hamlet probably spoke the speech. Is that right?
Speak the speech, I pray you, else I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But do not mouth it as many of our players do, for then I had as lief the tongue crier spoke her lines.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 529, Shakespeare's Original Pronunciation. We just spent a fantastic weekend at the annual conference of the Shakespeare Theater Association. It was hosted by the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company in their beautiful new theater in downtown Baltimore. And after we performed William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, Thursday night, I was able to just relax the rest of the weekend and spend it chatting with some wonderful Shakespeare folk, one of whom was Ben Crystal, the actor, author, director, and producer who is probably best known for researching, teaching, and writing about Shakespeare's original pronunciations. Ben sat down with me just literally before hopping into a cab to fly back to England, and I was thrilled to get to talk to him about his work. You call it original pronunciation, OP. How did you get started on this work?
Sure. Well, actually, it was my dad. My father called it original pronunciation. It's a tricky name because...
Your father, David Crystal.
My father, David Crystal, the linguist. Because a lot of people associate the term OP with original practices.
Right.
And indeed, that's not what this is. Well, I've been exploring, because of Dad's work in original pronunciation, I found myself exploring more and more and more in original practices. So OP, as it were, for me, was the catalyst, really. But Dad started it. He got called up by the Globe in 2004. And, of course, they'd been exploring the original practice of a building for a while. And they'd been doing costume and dance and music and fight. And they wondered whether they could do accent. A lot of people, as they still are today, you know, worry that it will be impenetrable. I think when people hear the word pronunciation especially, they have an idea that the high school teacher reading Chaucer, you know, the non est prestes tele, and that just being completely incomprehensible, which, as you know, you just heard, you know, OP is not. But they were still on the fence, and apparently the clincher was Tim Carroll said to the Globe, you know, if we don't do it, Stratford-on-Avon will.
Those bastards.
And you've never seen, right? And you've never seen a production greenlit faster.
That's fun. You know, I was just in a session here at the Stock Conference about the value of competition. And right there, yeah, a little spur in the backside.
Really?
Well, how did you begin, or how did your father begin his research? I mean, how do we know how they spoke back then?
So, three points of data, really, he tells me. You've got the rhymes in all the sonnets. Two-thirds of the sonnets don't rhyme in a modern English accent anymore. Midsummer Night's Dream, Richard II, all those rhyming plays. If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. It had to have been, either proved and loved or loved and proved.
Yeah.
And we know, we absolutely know that the only person to have ever elongated that vowel of love to love was Elvis Presley. So... So that's one source of data. Then you got the.
I love it that the King of Rock and Roll is a data point.
Exactly, right?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Then we got the spellings.
Right.
In the first folio, they used to spell a lot more than I used to speak. So words like film was sometimes spelled P-H-I-L-O-M-E, and that's a two-syllable word.
Yeah.
Film. And then actually, if you ever go to Northern Ireland or some parts of America, and they ask you if you want to come and see the film tonight.
Yeah.
That's an Elizabethan pronunciation that stayed with us.
Oh.
And then the third is there were linguists at the time. Ben Johnson, the playwright, wrote a pronouncing dictionary, and he went through all the different vowel sounds and the consonant sounds and whatnot and said, this is how we pronounce these. Now, of course, you know, history's written by the history makers, right?
Right.
So whether he was choosing the sounds that he liked and not the ones that he didn't like,
right.
But still, he would say things like... the R sound, we call this the canonis literatus, the doggy sound. Think grrr.
Right.
And whether that R sound was a uvular or an alveolar trill, like or just a r, like you have in modern American,
Or pirates.
Oh, and indeed, oh geez, every time I go into schools, I always give the kids a little blast of OP, and I say, what does it remind you of? And because, you know, people will say, oh, accents from all over the world, but all the kids will say is Pirates of the Caribbean.
Jack Sparrow.
Thank you, Johnny Depp. Giving life to Shakespeare, right?
Indeed, yeah.
But all of the, you know, those three chunks of data get you to about 90% right. And that last 10% drives my dad crazy. But 90% isn't bad for 400 years. Now for me, that extra 10% and one anecdote from the Globes rehearsals in 2004, because they were still tentative in 2004, so they did Romeo and Juliet, but they did most of the run in received pronunciation, you know, the Shakespeare of Laurence Olivier, as it were. And then they did three shows over a weekend in OP, but they found themselves having to re-rehearse the show pretty much. And the master of movement came in to a rehearsal and sat down next to Dad and went, my goodness, they're moving differently. And it's really, really interesting, because what happens is the placement of the vowels in the mouth go back, further back and further down. Your center shifts from sort of, you know, if I'm speaking like this, my center's somewhere up in my throat. Yeah. And if I start speaking like this, my center is down here in my gut. That shifts the way you stand. It shifts the way you move. All the elisions in the folio, it's not, you know, oh, it is my lady, oh, it is my love, oh, that she knew she were, but oh, it is my lady, oh, it is my love, yeah. Oh, that she knew she were. And you're stripping time off it. There's, you can hear that my voice register drops. That happens in both boys and girls. Yeah. The whole thing holistically has an effect on the movement of the company, the acting choices of the company. Now you're starting to, you see how the original practice of accent can bleed into the original practice of company, the original practice of movement around the stage itself.
Right.
And then in the audience's heads and the actor's heads, two things are happening with that last 10%. If you and I learn original pronunciation now, our original pronunciation will be 90% the same, and then 10%, well, 10% me, and my accent, as you can hear it, is part English, part Welsh, part Lancaster, where I went to university, part London, part transatlantic, and yours will be 10% you and all your linguistic, vocal, accent, fingerprint background.
Right.
So we form a company, and instead of us flattening out our individuality and our uniqueness in accent and sounding the same, we all do sound the same, but we're retaining our individuality.
Right.
For the audience, they are hearing a sound, because original pronunciation, the accent of Elizabethan London, is essentially the great, 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 great grandfather of every modern English accent, because right. that accent left London, went to Bristol, got on the boat, sailed on the Mayflower to the Americas, later on got sent to Bristol and down to the Antipodes. That accent proliferated the world. So audiences, rather than struggling with original Shakespeare and original pronunciation, the number one reaction is either, with adults, they sound a little bit like that where I come from. Mm. With the younglings, they say, it sounds a bit like us. Now, of course, it doesn't sound like them, but what they are saying is it no longer sounds like them with a capital T. It doesn't sound like the elite anymore. It doesn't sound like Shakespeare's accessible, because it sounds a little bit more
rough and real
and familiar. Yeah. And my goodness, you know, if there's one thing I've learned with Shakespeare, is the more tender we are with him, the further away he slips from us. And if we roll up our sleeves and get rough and ready with him and dare to cut him and treat him like his actors did, then he stays with us.
Well, yeah, Shakespeare was the least, it seems like the least precious artist that worked, you know. He just wanted to get in there and get it done. I've heard, I mean, this was now 20 years ago now, but maybe that parts of the American accent are as closer to how the Elizabethans spoke. And I'm not sure that's true, but it sounds like what I'm hearing from you say is that the American accent, is like many accents, is comes down to us from Shakespeare.
In part, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, every place will accommodate, I suppose. There's a linguistic trait of accommodation in that if I like you and you like me and we hang out for a while, our accents will meld together a little bit.
Yeah.
It happens in every metropolis. There was the idea that the accents gotten on the boat had become so isolated in some places that they stayed in stasis, but it's a lovely idea, and it's not true,
right.
Which is a shame.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a quality, I suppose, where that's a good thing, because we don't want the Globe, let's say, to be exactly like it was, because then it's a museum. right? We want to know what can working in an original practice space teach us about Shakespeare and provide us with footing and ground for the next 25 years, the next generation of potential Shakespeare lovers. Exactly the same with OP, you know. It's been really fascinating to explore what a third of the canon, I think, has been done now. There's two-thirds left. There's plenty more rhymes and puns and ideas and interpretations that haven't been found yet. At the end of that, it'll be great to, I mean, Dad's original pronunciation dictionary came out last year, so it's possible for people to work with it for evermore. But hopefully, you know, I don't think, you know, Shakespeare should forever be done in OP, but I do hope that hearing Shakespeare in OP will reset the balance a little bit more, perhaps provide the bridge for us to be able to accept and understand that there is no right accent for Shakespeare. Your accent is right for Shakespeare because you want to speak it.
Right.
You don't have to sound a particular sound. Yeah. Why should a particular type of art be beholden to a particular sound?
This is Alan Burrows from Shakespeare and Company, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSE? Our 50-city UK tour of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, begins with two performances this week at the Lighthouse in Poole, before moving on to the Norden Farm in Maidenhead and the Norwich Playhouse. I won't rattle off the other 47 cities, but they are up on our website now. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with Ben Crystal. Is there a sense, do we know that the way Elizabethan actors spoke was the way that Elizabethans spoke? I mean, in the way that, you know, sometimes you go to see a play and you go, oh, the actors are putting on their actor voices.
Right.
Do we think Elizabethans did that, or were they speaking the way the Elizabethans spoke?
I mean, we've got so little idea about their practice, mm-hmm. other than what we can divine from either the plays, you know, and goodness knows, trying to divine the man from the works is dangerous enough. So
yeah.
trying to divine, you know, whether or not... Yeah. The practice of the rehearsals in the mechanicals, for example, in the dream is accurate or what have you. We have no idea whether the actors playing Macbeth would have put on a Scottish brogue.
Yeah.
But what an interesting question.
Yeah.
Certainly when we did it, we had some Scottish actors putting on a Scottish OP
mm-hmm.
and or allowing the Scots to come through in their OP, and it certainly worked. We know that their general state of writing was heightened. You know, I mean, I remember being in school and asking the questions like everybody else, did they speak like this back then? Was it all these and thous and yous? And, you know, thou and you certainly was there, that
right.
difference between the formal and the informal way of saying you. Certainly, I think that some sort of lyricism must have crept into them. After working with this guy for, 10 years,
mm-hmm.
being in the Globe, constantly being in verse, being in that heightened craft state, I'm sure it must have infected their blood.
Yeah.
But it's definitely worth saying that the original pronunciation that we've been exploring, the data on which it's based, is, two-thirds
yeah.
from the canon?
Yeah.
So this is less the sound of Elizabethan London, and it's more the sound of, well, I suppose the Globe of those 20 actors or so. It's a very specific bite. And indeed, you know, if you go 10 years later to John Donne, I had to record a two-hour sermon of John Donne's from 1623 once, in an anechoic chamber. It's the quietest place on earth because they wanted to do a virtual St. Paul's and have you stand around the yard and the sound would be bouncing off and everything. It's a fascinating project online called
yeah.
the St. Paul's Cross Project. But even, you know, over the course of Shakespeare's time to John Donne, the word like musician, for example, would have started out as musician,
yeah.
have become musician,
uh-huh.
and then musician.
Okay.
That's in 20 years.
Wow.
So the accent, I mean, you know, Shakespeare was in early modern English. He's famous, as so many of his contemporaries are, for bringing so many new words to the language.
Mm-hmm.
The language was fast and changing and hot and vital and mercurial, I suppose.
Right. Well, and I suppose the average Elizabethan didn't sound like the average Elizabethan actor because they weren't speaking Shakespeare's language.
Also that,
yeah.
absolutely. I mean, the, you know, what 80% of them were illiterate.
Yeah.
A lot of them didn't get the kind of education that, well, they didn't get education, period, and certainly not the kind of education in the classics and, right, and everything that, that the actors would have received kind of by osmosis,
right,
from talking about Hercules and that.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing you touched on earlier is that when you use the OP, you tend to speak faster, and that always appeals to me. You know, come on, Shakespeare, get in, get out, get in and get out. Romeo and Juliet talk about the 2 hours traffic of our stage. Do you think that the plays were lasted, took less time to do back then?
Yeah, I mean, when they, okay, going back to that Romeo and Juliet performance, the performance in original pronunciation was 10 minutes faster than the performance in RP, and I imagine it would have been even faster if they'd got a proper, you know, run at it.
Oh, right, yeah.
It tripped them up, though, because the director had choreographed the sonnet when they meet to a dance and the music, and when they finish dancing and they finish speaking.
Uh-huh.
But in the OP version, they finished speaking and they still had a minute or two of dance left.
Oh, I love it.
I certainly adhere in my productions to a two-hour cut. I mean, 2 hours would have meant anything between the third and fourth tolling of the Southwark Cathedral bell after 2 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, in the region of two and a half hours, yeah, I suppose, is what they mean. And looking at, I mean, when we did Hamlet in OP in Reno, Nevada, of all places, it's a four-hour text, right? But
yeah.
We insisted on bringing it down to two and a half hours, including the interval, because, I mean, you know, certainly I don't think the Elizabethans would have been able to, they wouldn't have wanted to stand for that long.
Right.
They probably wouldn't have had the capacity to suspend their disbelief for that long, I suppose,
yeah,
if you
yeah.
want to use those terms. But also, equally, the light would have faded.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of them going on beyond five is madness, right?
So, yeah.
Maybe it would have been different in court. Maybe they would have spread the play out over the day, but...
So when you say you want a two-hour cut, you want to get... is it as much cutting the text as it is just picking up the pace of the text?
Definitely, both.
Yeah.
I think that...
I guess I'm remembering Mark Rylance famously said, you know, much of Shakespeare today is like Shakespeare in slow motion.
Oh, my God. I mean, talk about, you know, those old lessons of don't do the acting before the thought, do it on the thought.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he says, speak the speech as I pray, as I pronounce it to you, trippingly. Do it,
yeah.
You know, it's got a kick. I think that prose is should be probably lightning fast.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, from what we've learned about the way he manipulated the meter, he knew where he wanted the pauses to be.
Mm-hmm.
I try to, and I encourage the actors I work with to adhere to that too. But then also, yeah, I mean, if you go to the Smock Alley cut of Hamlet from 1676, check out the facsimile of that, because the way that they cut was really interesting. And that's one of the earliest copies of cut Shakespeare that we've got. There are bits where they've very carefully drawn a massive X through a whole column of a page. There are other bits where they've very carefully gone through particular lines, and there are other bits where they've just hacked it down. And it's back to what we said, you know, you've got to be rough with this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got to look at the bust in the corner of the room, if you have one. I encourage people to do that and go, Shakespeare, listen, man, we've been trying to make this joke work. We've tried every which way. We've tried it 50 different ways. It's not funny. Can we cut it? And he's like, of course you should cut it. Create the best 2 hours traffic of entertainment. I want to make people laugh.
Yeah.
I want to make people cry.
Yeah.
That was my business. Why are you being beholden to a clown joke of 400 years old when, you know, that's like people not cutting a joke from Chandler and Friends in 400 years' time just out of some sort of perverse idea that we have to be faithful. You know, he wanted to entertain.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't, you know, be afraid to chop him up, I suppose.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your original pronunciation via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @AustinTichner. Thanks, as always, to Down with OP Matthew Croke, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Han Preston. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Alan Burrows, the artistic director of Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Massachusetts. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 529 1587ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
It's so great to finally meet you, because 2 years ago we exchanged tweets because your video helped my daughter in an English class perform, I think it was Sonnet 116.
Oh, wow.
In OP. And she got an A. But also, that's it was just great. A great way to introduce this idea that Shakespeare isn't precious, that, you know, there's all sorts of ways to speak the speech. Mm-hmm. Do you know Sonnet 116?
I do. Yeah. Should I do it?
Yeah.
What's your daughter's name?
Daisy.
Okay, well, this is for Daisy. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with a remover to remove. Oh, no. It is an ever fixed mark which looks on tempest but is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark whose worth's unknown although his height be taken. Love's not time's full, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief oars and wakes, but bears it out into the edge of dumb. If this be error and upon me proved, I never read, nor no man e'er loved.
This podcast is a production of the Reduce Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reduceshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.